Well, as you know, or at least as I hope you know, we're a Pro Football Hall of Fame themed podcast. But Ira and I both like to watch collegiate basketball, too. And unlike Ira, I think I prefer watching the women's game more, partly because I live in Connecticut, but mostly because I get to watch the UConn women, Ira. And they had a great run this year against all odds. Maybe you know this, down in Tampa, maybe you don't. But this year they went to the Final Four, where unfortunately they ran into Caitlin Clark in Iowa. But a great, great run. But as you guys do know, and most of our audience knows, the UConn men, they won the national title for the second straight year. And I can only imagine what it's like to be on the store's campus this week. Except, Ira, we have someone with us today who knows what it's like, and that's UConn football coach Jim Mora, whom I first got to know when he joined the San Diego Chargers in 1985 as a defensive assistant. And I think it was quality control, defensive assistant. Anyway, I covered that team. And then years later, when I covered the 49ers, he was a defensive coordinator there and a defensive backs coach as well. But Jim has been a successful coach at the pro and collegiate levels. And he joins us today from where else, Ira? Stores, Connecticut. And Jim, first of all, great to see you. Haven't talked to you in a while, but what's it like to be on that campus the past few weeks?
It's electric. Think about having both your men's and women's team in the Final Four and the women against enormous odds. Yeah. And then your men win the national championship. It's been captivating. And you know, you so look forward to the games. It was like last night, it was like withdrawal. Like, what do we watch? You know, we can't watch Paige.
That's right.
We can't watch Donovan. Who do we watch? But it's been awesome, you know. And the basketball facility is right across from our facility. So you get to know the players. Obviously, knowing Gino and Danny has been amazing. But it's just been electric. They got back, you know, late in the evening yesterday. And I'm sure we have an on-campus celebration for them. But I'll tell you what, it just pumps energy into everybody on campus. Now, the one thing that it took a little toll on our players yesterday morning, we had an 8 o'clock practice after the, it was 9:20 tip off here. So I think some of those guys stayed up and celebrated a little bit too late. So we got a little bit of a slow start to practice, but it's awesome, Clark. It's fantastic.
So did you go to the games? Do you go to the men's and women's games?
I go to the home games, yeah, and I'll sometimes go to the Big East tournament, and I've probably gone to twice as many women's games than men's games, and I'm a fan of both teams, and I love the coaches, and I love it, but there's something about watching the development of the women's side in basketball that's just so compelling to me. The level of ability, the skills, the way they move the ball around. And with our women especially, they're so connected in the way that they play. And then I love stories of adversity and overcoming adversity. And you look what they did this year with the number of athletes that they lost during the season and still being able to get to the Final Four was just, to me, a testament to Gino and the culture that he's built and the athletes that he's brought into that culture and the way they've just embraced it.
Yeah, our family just loves watching UConn women's basketball. In fact, we watch them more than the men, a lot more than the men, because we love seeing Paige Beckers, Nika Mule. I love watching Nika Mule and Lee Edwards. Although it was just so much fun to watch them this year. And I will say, at the start of this year, my wife said, "How far do you think they can go?" I went, "With these injuries, they'll be lucky to get past the 16. Maybe they get to the Elite Eight, it'll be a miracle." And they get the Final Four and came within 2 points or 3 points of getting to the championship game. A really testament.
Yeah, Paige is.
To me, a testament to the greatness of that program, Gino Auriemma, and the players in that program.
Tell you what's really fun to do is to go watch their practice. And I do that on occasion. And both Gino and Danny, it becomes very apparent when you watch the practice why they're so successful. They're very organized. They're very detailed. They're incredibly demanding. They're upbeat. Those guys are tremendously involved. You know, they're not sit back with their arms back coaches. I mean, they're going the whole time. They inject energy into their program. The level of demand that they put on their players on a daily basis, is very, very high, and their players strain to reach it every day. They just, there's just a, it's very similar. Now they have a different style in terms of, you know, Danny's a little louder than Gino. Yep. Gino's a little quieter, but it's to me, it's been a great lesson. And basketball is different than football because you're dealing with 15 rather than 125. Yeah. But just their approach to, like with Danny, what I love about Danny is that he's an animal during practice, an animal. And he's so demanding on those guys. Never
he's an animal during the games too, isn't he?
Yeah, but during the game, like on in practice, he's on his guys. During the games, he's their biggest cheerleader. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you know, it's fun to see that. I've always tried to be that way, demanding during practices, you know, on them. And then during the game, they need you the most and be there for them. And you just see it work for Danny and for Gino. It's a great education for me, even at my age, and having experience and watching two of the greats of all time do it.
Jimmy, what's it like coaching maybe a half an hour from, you know, the worldwide sports leader in Hartford? Jim, have you been over to the campus many times, and what kind of presence do they have on your campus?
Well, I actually worked there for over 3 years. So I was on campus, worked for on their college football shows. And so I spent a lot of time on that campus. Interestingly enough, in the 2 years since I've been back, I haven't been over there. I haven't had the time, you know. But it's, you know, they're there, but we're not that engaged with them. What's great though is Dan Orlovsky and Molly Kierum, they're UConn grads. And so the shows that they're on, they're always pumping UConn up, and having Dan send you a text or Molly send you a text or come to an event, you know, that's the impact. But, you know, in terms of having it as a resource in recruiting and just people, you know, these players knowing that it's so close, and if they are interested in that industry, having some access to it, I think it's a real positive for us.
What's going on with the football program, Jim? Which way is the arrow pointing?
The arrow's pointing up, okay? It really is. You know, this has been a program that has struggled for consistency for a long, long time. Hasn't really been known as a powerhouse. We came in here a couple years ago, and, you know, it had been really, really down. And we got to a bowl our first year. And then last year, we, you know, in terms of our record, we took a step back. In terms of our development, we took a step forward, which I think is hard to explain to people because really, you know, the record is what you're judged upon. But I'm excited about the people we have in the building. It's a great group of young men. Our players, their attitude, their effort, their commitment are as good as I've been around. You know, we just have to continue to really do the right things in terms of coaching them, putting them in the right spot, recruiting well. It never hurts when, you know, your basketball team is so prominent. It draws eyes, you know, so we'll capitalize on that as best we can. But I think the arrow's pointing up. I'm excited about it, Ira.
One quick one before I turn it back over to Clark. Jim, now I got to know you very well when you were with the Falcons, and I would, you know, during training camp, make a little trip to the Flowery Branch or whatever and see you, and you were very accommodating. Jim, your first year there, 04, Jimmy, you got a 5-11 team. You turn it around. I mean, immediately. You didn't waste any time. 11-5. And then the next 2 years were not, you know, up to your expectations. Looking back, Jim, what happened in the arc of your career in Atlanta?
Well, we were 11-5, went to the NFC Championship game, and I think we came back at 8-8. And I still felt like we were in pretty good shape. And then I think in 2006, you know, the injury bug just killed us. We finished 7-9. Right. I don't think the record was the reason that I got let go in Atlanta. I think it's because I was an idiot on the radio with Hugh Millen and Softy Mahler and KJ Aaron, if you remember the comments I made about wanting to go back to the University of Washington coach. So, but a lot's been learned since those days. You know, I really loved Atlanta. I loved living there. I loved the people there. My family was very happy there. I loved the organization. And quite frankly, you know, when I look back at it and I'm really honest and critical, I screwed it up. you know, I screwed it up, and I wish I hadn't have, because that would have been a place that I would have loved to stay for a long, long time. You know, got an owner in Arthur Blank who's very supportive. He doesn't have patience necessarily, which a lot of, you know, owners don't, but I took a lot of lessons from that, when to keep my mouth shut. And, you know, this was before the word viral, but I think I probably went viral for those comments. I know it was brutal. It was brutal.
We're with University of Connecticut football coach Jim Moore on the eye test for two. And we sure hope Jim's not hoping to go back to the University of Washington. Now we need him here in Connecticut. Jim, you talked about lessons and you talked about lessons learned there, but you also mentioned earlier great education and lessons you learned from Gino Orem and Danny Hurley. What sort of education did you get being around those two in the last couple of years?
Just how to handle things. You know, it's a Hall of Fame podcast or Hall of Fame base. So what's really interesting is that in my career, which is now, I think, close to 40 years, mm-hmm. I've had the opportunity to either directly coach in the Pro Bowl, work for or work with in media 55 members of the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And I don't know how many people can say that. I mean, that's a pretty large number. And like, I learned lessons from all those people. Think about it, I was around Jim Finks. I was around Bill Walsh. Now I've been around, you know, Mike Holmgren, Terry Donahue was always around UCLA. Yeah, right. You know, my dad's a pretty good one. I don't want to leave anyone out, obviously. Around Don Coryell.
Yeah, right, right.
And now to be around Gino, who's a legend, and Danny, who I'm going to say that he's probably too young to be considered a legend, but he will be considered a legend for sure. I think, you know, we all want to be a little bit older, but to be around greatness like that, it's amazing, you know, the things that you see. But I learned the most from the players that I was around. You know, being around Jerry Rice, let's just take Jerry Rice, for example, mm-hmm. and I could name, you know, 40 others, but seeing the level or the standard that they held themselves to, their work ethic, you know, their persistence, their ability to overcome obstacles, their ability to focus and concentrate on one thing and eliminate distractions. Those are the things that I learned, you know, being around those guys that had great talent, but took it to another level because of their great mental approach, their heart, their will to win, things like that. Those are the lessons that I learned that I try to pass on to the players that I'm fortunate to coach right now. And I think those are the important lessons, you know, just their attention to detail, the way they were in meetings, the way they practiced, all those things. You know, when you're talking about some of the greats, which I've been lucky to be around, you can take those lessons and pass them on to college guys.
Mm-hmm. Jim, I'll be honest with you. I once knew a pro coach who said, this was years ago, a long time ago, he'd consider coaching at the University of Connecticut, but he says it's just too hard to win there. It's the competition. It's tough to recruit there. It's a basketball school. It's not a football school. How difficult is that for you in the situation you're in? When you talk about the University of Connecticut to anyone across the country, they go, oh, yeah, basketball. Paige mm-hmm. Beckers, Danny Hurley, Gino, they know that. They don't know much about football. How difficult is that?
It's hard, but you have to put your ego aside. I mean, it's hard. It's hard from an ego or emotional standpoint, because yeah. I'm used to competing at the highest level everywhere I've been. You know, when you're in the NFL, when you're at UCLA, when I played at University of Washington, even back to high school and junior high, I was competing for championships, always, always. Mm-hmm. And so it's been difficult. You know, we have a lot of challenges that we face here. You know, there's only two independents left, us and Notre Dame. Yeah. You know, we're not in a conference. We can't play for a conference championship. We don't have a stadium on campus. You know, that makes it difficult. There's not a history of success. There's really no pedigree here. There's nothing to reach back into the future from and or into the past and you know, grab the attention of recruits. But I love challenges, you know, and we have a lot of challenges present opportunities as well. You know, we've got an administration that's pretty supportive. We've got an outstanding facility. You know, you've known me a long time, Clark. You know, I like to go uphill. You know, I'm a mm-hmm. I'm a hiker. I'm a mountain biker. I'm, you know, skinning, which is basically skiing uphill. You know, I like those things. So that's kind of a metaphor, I think, for where I'm at right now. It's a challenge, and it's it's extremely rewarding when positive things happen, when you see your program moving in a positive direction, when you see players that you're coaching doing really good things or moving in a way that points to success. And so those are the things I'm focusing on. I think that, you know, it's, there's some up and down days, but it's overall, it's very rewarding to be at a place like this just because of the challenges that we are trying to overcome.
I got two more for you, Jim. It's great to see you again, Jimmy. I wish we meet in person next time.
All right, you can meet him when you come up here to Connecticut and you take me out to lunch, okay?
Jim, you mentioned Jerry Rice. I want to get back to it for a second. Jim, to me, you had an extraordinary vantage point for some of those years in San Fran. Towards the end of Jerry's career with the Niners and the beginning of Terrell Owens' era in San Francisco. Jim, what was it like to see those two? Did they share some qualities together? And what was it like in practices against those two, Jim, at that time?
Well, I was the defensive back coach and then the defensive coordinator. So practices weren't always fun, you know. They both had very similar qualities, different personalities. They both had tremendous work ethic, a drive to be great, a relentless pursuit of perfection. It wasn't unusual to come in at 6 a.m. on a practice day and Jerry be on the treadmill running. It wasn't unusual to walk down into the weight room at 10:30 at night during a game week and have T.O. down there lifting. They were incredibly competitive on the practice field in everything that they did, not necessarily against each other, but against the defense. And so you as a defensive player, as a defensive coach, you had to be on it all the time. You know, with T.O., when he was young, he and I, we had a really good banter, and we still actually communicate. It was fun to, it's interesting to kind of watch his career trajectory and some of the things that happened to him. But I used to have him in practice because when he would pop off, you know, I'd say, hey, you talk to me when you get to a Pro Bowl, you know. And that was kind of my thing to stick him. And then all of a sudden he started, you know, making Pro Bowls and I had nothing to say to him anymore. But it was fun. And, you know, the thing that I took from it, much like I took from all those great ones that I was lucky enough to be around, was that competitive drive, that extreme ability to hold themselves accountable that made them unique. Yeah, great athletes, great players, but that competitiveness and that inability to excuse themselves was what I think was one of the qualities that made them so special.
Was Owens flamboyant, Jim, in the beginning, or was he kind of reserved?
Well, he came from a small school. He wasn't well known. He was reserved. I think that he got to a point where, he realized that he was, coming of age. We're not going to say that he was on Jerry's level yet, but he was reaching that. And I think he wanted to be seen. And so he came out of his shell, as he attained success. I think, I don't know how many people remember this, but, what was going to be Jerry's last game was Jerry's last game at Candlestick. T.O. caught 20 passes, and I think that every you remember that, Clark? And every,
I do. I remember that
every
well.
Every call on the call sheet was designed to go to Jerry. And yet T.O. caught 20 passes, and we're taking Jerry off the field on our shoulders after the game. There's a great picture of Bryant Young carrying Jerry off the field, and T.O. caught 20 balls. So to me, that kind of shows you, T.O. is like, hey, don't forget about me over here. I can do some damage too.
Jim, last one for me. I want to ask you about two Hall of Fame candidates. One drives me and Clark crazy because he doesn't get any traction. You coached against them. Jim, and we think the guy at least deserves a conversation, and that's Hines Ward, Jim, and a guy close to me and close to you. He had three great years during your 3 years in Atlanta, Jim, and that's Warrick Dunn, was a heck of a player for Jim Mora. He doesn't get any traction. Running backs are devalued a little bit, Jim, even the old ones. Talk a little bit about Ward and Warrick Dunn.
Well, Hines Ward was always a problem. And to me, it all boiled down to his toughness and competitiveness. I mean, he was as tough as they get. He was a great blocker. He was a sure and steady receiver. He didn't have the flash that some of those other guys did, but as a defensive coach, defensive coordinator trying to prepare for him, you knew that you were going to have to bring it and he was going to make plays and he was consistent. And, you know, I had, when you started to talk, I thought you were going to talk about Isaac Holt, but Hines, yeah, great player. I mean, great player. And then, you know, it's interesting that Warrick has been overlooked and I'm not sure why. You know, you look at his career and what he did in Tampa and what he did in Atlanta, and for his stature, I mean, he's a special player. I mean, he was one of the better players I've ever coached. And not only that, but what a great human being. You know, the things that he's done now in his life off the field, starting with his homes to the hall for the holidays, being a part owner of the Falcons. You know, he just won a big award in the NFL as a humanitarian. Those are two guys that I think are certainly worthy of being in the Hall of Fame. They're in my Hall of Fame, I can tell you that.
Jim, running backs getting disrespected in today's age. People like to slap them around saying you don't need a running back. You can get one in the sixth round and they're, you know, interchangeable. Well, what's going on there?
I think it's cyclical. I think that, you know, teams probably got away from running the ball, became a very pass-happy league, and I think that it'll make its way back. You know, I think that, you know, if you have a great running back or two, probably need two now with the pounding that they take, you know, you're always going to have a chance to be successful. But I think, you know, in the old days, you didn't split up carries like you have to now. I mean, just the grind of the season, the physicality of the game is different. It's different than when I first started in the league in, like Clark said, 1985, 1984, five. It was different. And so when you need to have two great ones, you know, maybe you just, you make your investment a little bit differently than you would if you could just play with one.
We're speaking with University of Connecticut football coach Jim Mora on the eye test for two. And Jim, a couple questions going back to Atlanta and then also Seattle where you coached. You've been successful in the NFL as a coach. You've been successful at the collegiate level, UCLA. Now you're at UConn. Aside from recruiting, what's the biggest difference in terms of coaching a collegiate and a pro team? Maybe in terms of the players, what you have to deal with and the challenges you have?
It's not as different as you'd think. You know, recruiting's recruiting.
Do you like it? Do you like to recruit?
I do. I do like to recruit. The portal is a lot like free agency.
Yeah.
This transfer portal has changed a lot, you know, and the NIL has changed a lot. I still enjoy the challenge of it. You know, the skill set of the players is a little bit different, obviously, you know, and there's a lot more disparity week to week in the teams that you compete against. You're going to play some great, great, great teams and you're going to be really overmatched. And then you're going to play some teams that, you know, you're a lot better than, and you're going to play some teams where it's equal, but there's not as much disparity in the NFL as there is in college. But what I found is that the players, if they think that you can help them become better, then they're going to buy in no matter what level it is. On colleges, campuses, the demands are different than in the NFL. You know, the NFL players are spending all day at football. In college, they've got to balance the books and their social life and growing up, maturing from a 17-year-old sometimes into a, you know, a man ready to go out in the world. The game's very much the same. I think some of the rules are different. You know, college football is finally adopting the 2-minute rule, I believe, that we have in the NFL. I'd like to see the NFL adopt the college football pass interference rule, you know, but the game's the game, quite frankly. One difference, and it is attached really to the disparity or lack of, is game management. I don't think it's put it enough of a premium in college football as it is in the pro game. You know, so many pro games come down to that last drive or two. Yeah. And I don't think that people pay enough attention to that. And I think it's a place you can gain a real advantage in college football.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned NIL and the transfer portal, because as you know, speaking of Hall of Fame, a Hall of Famer, future Hall of Famer, Nick Saban left Alabama this year, and he did say the NIL money and the transfer portal influenced his decision to leave. And now this week we have Tara Vanderveer, Hall of Famer from Stanford, women's basketball coach. She's left, but she didn't say anything, at least up to this point, about the NIL and transfer portal. I think it had to have some sort of influence. You referred to it earlier. How's it changed your profession, either generally or specifically in how you go about your job?
Well, unfortunately, well, first of all, I'm a proponent of players getting compensated in some way. I think that, you know, yeah, they get a scholarship, but I don't think people understand the commitment these players have to make in football specifically in terms of time and energy and what it does to their body. It's different than anything else. But I think that it's changed. It's become more transactional than relationship driven. Your relationship sometimes with your players, which I don't necessarily enjoy, but it's part of it. You know, we all would love players to come here because they know that you can help develop them and they can help you win and they want to be a part of something special. And it's not like that for everyone. You know, some of it's just about the money. So I think you have to be really careful when you go out and you procure players from the portal, that you're not bringing in guys that are going to ruin the culture that you're trying to build just because they maybe are going to get you an extra first down or two.
Yeah.
So you have to be really careful. And I also think it's giving you a chance to better your team rather quickly, because you know, you can bring in some players that are developed and ready to play physically, mentally, emotionally, experience-wise, where, you know, in the old days, it was always a freshman developing through his senior year. So it's changed a lot, but, you know, you just have to be really careful about doing your research on the guys that you want to bring in. And the other thing that's changed is you're constantly recruiting your own players, you know, because you don't want to lose your players. Sometimes you want to lose some of your players, but you don't typically you don't want to lose your players. So it makes it tough, you know. And Danny Hurley said it a year or so ago about NIL. He said, you never want a player to come to UConn just because of money, but you never want to lose a player because of money either. So I think that's our approach, you know, and our collective has done an unbelievable job of filling the coffers for us in football. Last year at this time, we had no money, zero. Maybe we at some point got to $100,000. And this year, our people have raised over $1 million for us. And that's at the group of five level, which is really good. And we've got a guy named Mike Burton, who our building's named after. He's just so committed to it. And he's doing a great job of bringing all the old players back and explaining to them how important it is to have NIL money. So
do you sense this thing turning around at Connecticut in terms of football? Do you sense it turning around?
Hell yeah, Clark. Come on, man. That's why I'm here.
That's a leading question. You know, I'd expect you to say yeah.
Listen, it's hard. It's really hard, but I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't have hope. You know?
No, I know that. But I mean, I just
glass
can't imagine.
Full guy.
Yeah, but, it's so tough to be there. You know, as I said. We talk, as I said, every winter we talk about basketball, but a lot of people in this area talk about the men's game. Honestly, as these guys don't know, I don't think, but I think as many or more people in the state talk about the women's game here. They're for years,
probably.
I mean, they've 20, 30 years of women's basketball. It's been great. And you've got to somehow get that conversation, not necessarily on that level, but you get it, you know, in that direction. That's got to be tough.
It is. I mean, we're definitely third at the university. Yeah. Shoot, maybe, you know, to some, we might be fourth or fifth because we've got a pretty darn good baseball team and, you know, our hockey team is pretty good. But you know what? We're just going to worry about us and we're going to keep grinding away and keep trying to get to bowl games and keep recruiting good players and, you know, trying to retain what I think is a really good staff, create some consistency. You know, we've got to go win some games that we're not favored to win. You know, we got to go beat couple power five teams a year and win the ones that we're supposed to win. And all of a sudden, you know, people will stand up and take notice and we'll grow this thing. I think it's really important that eventually we get in a conference. You know, we need to get in a power five program. That changes everything because of the resources available to you.
Right.
You know,
right.
We're getting a lot of recruiting battles with people. They love it here because they love the people. They love the program. They love our vision. They love the facilities. And then a power five team jumps in and, you know, they go there. So, like I said, there's a lot of challenges. It's very, very hard. But all that being said, we love it. I love it. I love the challenges. I love the people I get to work with. So, you know, we just got to win games.
All right. I always love it when a West Coast guy comes east and says, I love it here. I like that. a couple last things. I mentioned Falcons players to you. One thing that gets me today is when we see a quarterback who can run and throw and do everything, they go, we've never seen this before. I go, wait a second. I mean, I'm old enough to have been around to see Randall Cunningham, Steve Young. How about Michael Vick? All right.
Yeah.
People kind of forgot how good a player Michael Vick was. You certainly haven't.
He was special. He, He did everything. Every day he did something I'd never seen before. Every day there was, oh, wow moment. And I'd look at Napper, you know,
oh, yeah.
May he rest in peace. One of my, you know, best friends of my life, who I miss every day. And Napper and I would look at each other every day in practice, go, did you just see that? You know, whether it was with his feet or with his arm, he was spectacular. And, you know, I think, you know, his legacy for so long was tainted by what happened off the field. And I think people are starting to maybe move past that and recognize him for who he is. He seems to be, he's becoming more visible again. He's doing good work on Fox. I've always contended that Michael Vick was a really good person who just made a couple bad decisions. Like, you know, we all do. Shoot. We all do. I raised my hand first, but I'm cheering for him. You know, I loved coaching him. I mean, he was a joy to coach, a joy to coach, you know, and some fun times on the field, you know, during games. Napper, you're talking about Greg Knapp, for anyone that doesn't know, but who passed away almost 2 years ago. You know, Napper, we'd call a timeout. I think we were playing the Saints or maybe it was the Panthers. It was like a fourth down play, and we had to score to win the game. And Napper brings Mike over, and Napper's giving him all the, okay, think about this, this, this. If it's not there, do this, do that, do this. And Mike starts to run back on the corner or on the field, and I call Mike. I go, Mike, come here. And Napper's standing there. He goes, what's up? I go, if you don't like it, just run. And he runs back on the field. Napper looks at me. He goes, why would you tell him that? I said, you're Mike Vick, man. And he runs and dives into the end zone and we win the game. You know, so sometimes you can overcoach guys like that.
Oh, that's right. I mean,
I think the Falcons, Jim, during all three of your years, you led the league in rushing yards all three
every year.
Seasons.
3 years in a row, we led the NFL in rushing yards. And I don't know if it still stands, but we had a playoff record for most rushing yards. We played the Rams in the divisional game in 2005, early 2005, after the 2004 season. And, you know, people go, boy, you guys must have been able to run the ball. And I was like, yeah, we could, but we also have this guy, Mike Vick, who gave us about 1,000 yards a year, too. So,
well, that story reminds me of one that Fouch used to tell about Don Coryell and when they had John Jefferson. And he said they were playing the Raiders. I think it was a nationally televised game. Late in the game, they're driving the length of the field. And Fouts comes to the sidelines. And this is when Joe Gibbs was with him. And so Gibbs gets him on the headset. And he's telling about read the safety, watch the corner, do this, look for that. And he starts to go back on the field. And Coryell yells to him, hey, Danny, just throw it to JJ. And he said, that's what I did. It was very simple. Just throw it to JJ. That's what I did. We won the game.
I heard that about Kellen Winslow when I was there. Coach Coryell, you know, just said to Danny, hey, Danny, just throw it to the big guy. Just throw it to the big guy. Talk about Kellen, you know. We make the game so complicated. Just give it to the guy that can make plays, man.
That's right.
The ball was in Mike Vick's hands. You felt pretty good.
Yeah, you did. And last question, self-serving question. You've been at UCLA, so obviously you've been in Pauley Pavilion. You're at UConn. Now you're at Gamble. Where's the electricity better?
Well, you know, when I was at UCLA – they were, you know, a little bit down in basketball. And I came to UConn and, you know, we're going like this.
Yeah.
There's a lot to do in LA. There's not a lot to do in stores. So I'm going to tell you, it's a resounding answer for Stores Connecticut and Gamble. It's unbelievable in there. I mean, it's unbelievable. If we could just get part of that at our football games, I'd be happy, you know, but like our students are rabid. When we won the other night, you know, it was about 11:30 at night, I think, when the game ended, and the honking, the horns, music playing. Cause like I told you, I'm running on campus, kids everywhere. I mean, it was pretty spectacular.
Yeah. When's the last time you experienced that down in Tampa?
My wedding night. My wedding.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ira. Hey, Jim, thanks so much for the time. Great to see you. And listen, I may see you next week when we tour stores and the University of Connecticut.
We'll go over, and if Gino's around, we'll go introduce you to Gino.
My wife will faint. Thanks very much. Thanks, Jim. Really appreciate it.
Great talking to you. See you, Ira.
See you, right.
That was University of Connecticut head football coach Jim Mora. And all right, I love talking to him. And Jim, who's going to run for mayor of Torres apparently someday, based on what he had to say about Connecticut and everything. But, you know, it's interesting when you brought up Terrell Owens. I was there for his career. I was there his first year, completely different player. When you asked about, you know, being flamboyant, wasn't flamboyant at all very reserved, extraordinarily polite. And I did notice a change as things went on. I'm not going to go in detail, but I noticed him changing and becoming more of himself, whether that's good or bad, people can disagree on. But he changed as time went on. But when he first came, he was a completely different player.
Do you think, Clark, you think Jim Mora will ultimately be successful?
I don't know. It's so tough, Ira. It's so tough to win there. Because there's just not the buzz that there is about the basketball program. He's right. The baseball team is really good, too. I'd love to see it happen. I'd love to see him turn that thing around. He did that at UCLA. You know, I think in his first year, I think he was like, 9-5? Then he was 10-3 and then 10-3. I mean, they were really successful when he was there. But it's different recruiting at UCLA for football than it is recruiting the University of Connecticut. I mean, how much
where do they play, Clark? Where are they playing their home games? Where?
They play some in Hartford, I think, or near Hartford. I honestly don't know. I haven't been to one. I mean, that shows you I haven't been to one, and I should. Honestly, I should. His first year.
They don't have an on-campus stadium. They don't have.
No,
one.
They've got the Dodd Stadium, which is where they've got that, which is off campus, and it's close to stores, but it's not on campus. But then they'll play some in the Hartford area, and I'm trying to think where it is. It's not Chris Dodd, obviously. He was a senator here, but they have a stadium that's near there. But yeah, none on campus. That does hurt. But I mean, the fact of the matter is, Ira, UCLA Stadium's not on campus either. It's the Rose Bowl, you know. But you've got a history there that's really good. You've got a history of the basketball program here that's really good. So he's up against a tough situation.
I'm just trying to picture you going to lunch with Mora and Auriemma, and who's going to pick up the check, Clark? Who?
They're going to have to pick me up from the floor first. Gino's at this table. I'll faint before my wife will. I know when I go out with you, Ira. I know when I go out with you, who picks up the check? And it ain't Ira.
Well, our thanks go out to Jim Mora. He was excellent today.
He's terrific. Yeah. I really hope he gets a turnaround. I think it's a daunting task, but I really hope he gets a turnaround. All right, quickly, final thoughts for this week.
Final thoughts, my friend. Well, I learned today, an hour ago, Clark, I'm breaking news on the show. I hope Ian Glendon doesn't spit out his coffee, but I met with the orthopedist about an hour and a half ago, and he looked at the x-rays and said, your bone on bone, Kaufman. Your bone. He didn't call me Sage. Called me Kaufman. Looks like hip replacement, Clark. Oh. Hip replacement for the Sage. A month from now, I'm going to be all hobbled up. The summer's coming on. The heat's coming on. How am I supposed to walk around the block, Clark, to rehab? And when it's 93 with 80% humidity, what am I going to do?
Ask your wife. That's why she's there. She's going to push you in the wheelchair, Ira. Listen, I've got a next door neighbor, honestly, who went through the exact same thing. He was in a wheelchair for a while. He walks with a cane now, but he's getting better. My brother's got both hips done. He still's very active. So it's very common, but unfortunately that you got 2 months of hell, Ira.
I guess I'm human, Clark, but the technology is much better, Clark. Yeah. I don't think it's as bad as a knee replacement. I don't.
No.
So what do you got going on? How's your health, my friend?
It's okay. Yeah, it's good. And nothing like that. But, you know, it's just a matter of time. We're like automobiles. You know, as time goes on, the parts just wear out, right? And so we got to get them replaced.
I got a big birthday in August, Clark. It ain't 40. Let's put it like that.
I see you're in my rearview mirror, Ari. You're coming closer to me. You know, it says images aren't as large as they appear. No, they are. I see you right in my rearview mirror.
Then we got our young producer, Ian Glendon, who's barely 25 over there, Clark. I mean,
I know. You know, it's funny when we talk about these guys in the past. He's going, who? What? No, he's in a story. And that's what we love about him. But some of those stories we tell are I'm just going to go, wait a minute, Ian wasn't even born then. We were covering a team. I mean, God.
Clark, we got to check in with Mr. Glendon today on April 11th and see what he's thinking about with that that third pick in the draft. What do you got, Ian? What do you got?
It feels like they're going more and more quarterback. You know, it looks like that's what they're kind of focusing in on. They didn't quite have the huge spending offseason that I think a lot of fans expected. In fact, they brought back a lot of Belichick guys, coincidentally. But no, I think they're going to go the safe pick and take a quarterback. Now, who that is, I don't know, but that's part of the fun of it, I guess.
Who would you take, Harrison?
Yeah, I did. You know, I mean,
if he's there,
I trade back. That's me. Oh, I trade back, probably draft, you know, build that line. But, I think the pressure from ownership to get a quarterback is ultimately going to weigh out over anything.
Clark, are you sold on McCarthy?
I don't know that much about him. Whenever I saw him, he played well, but I don't watch the college game that much, Ira. I really don't. Whenever I've seen him, he's played well, certainly was part of a successful program. But I worry about guys who suddenly appear 1 year and they look great, but then I go back to Joe Burrow. You know, Joe Burrow is that last year at LSU. I don't know that I've seen a better college quarterback that year. I mean, it's just, he was spectacular. And I think he's a terrific pro quarterback if they can keep him healthy.
Well, I remember you had that 1 year in 2004, Clark. You know, you raised your game that year, and then you pushed back to where you would normally be.
Yeah, I got a hip replacement, you know, so I was never the same. So Ira, what I would like to mention here, unfortunately, is I often use this segment to talk about the passing of someone I either covered or respect in this profession. And this time it's someone who fits both those descriptions. Talking about someone you might remember, and that's San Diego Chargers tight end Eric Sievers. He passed away this week at the age of 66. I know Jim talked about Kellen Winslow. Eric played behind Kellen, and he was a great blocker. They had three really good tight ends, Kellen Winslow, Eric Sievers, and Pete Holohan. Holohan was so good, they call him Hans Holohan in terms of catching, but Sievers was the blocker, and he was a solid player. But beyond that, Ira, he was a great individual. He was a better individual, and he's one of the classiest and gracious players I've been around. You would know those kind of guys. You go to them in the locker room because they're go-to guys. He was always there. It made me very sad to hear that.
Well, there are times, Clark, when Coryell would use two tight ends.
Oh, sure. A lot. Yeah, a lot. Because Kellen was like a wide receiver. A lot. And it's interesting to hear Jim talk about Kellen. I've often said the greatest or the most talented wide receiver I ever covered was Jerry Rice. I mean, and the most talented, put it another way, the most talented football player I ever covered was Jerry Rice. Never saw anyone who could do the things he did. But second was Kellen Winslow. When I saw him in practice, I went, my God, this guy can do everything. And so that story he told about Coryell doesn't come as a surprise.
How come, Clark, how come nobody ever caught Jerry Rice from behind? Well, why? Why? His time in the combine was not extraordinary. Why?
Why didn't they catch him from behind? Because they weren't fast enough, Ira. That's usually why they don't catch him from behind. I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's a good question. Yeah, and backed off Dallas. Dallas said, oh, he's too slow. You know, and San Francisco lucked into him. But they managed that draft so that they could get him. They were smart enough to move up and get him. But, sometimes I think all those numbers that people fall in love with the draft, I don't care about. Like, does it really make a difference what a quarterback runs for a 40? Certainly didn't with Tom Brady.
No. What did Walsh used to tell you, Clark, about scouting Jerry Rice in college and what he saw on tape?
I remember one story talking about we turned on some highlights late in the evening. It must have been, I don't know, ESPN wasn't. It wasn't real big then, but it was around. And he said every time I saw him, he mentioned what you did. Nobody could catch him from behind. So why is everyone talking about that he doesn't have the speed? He said every time I looked at a highlight of this guy, and he was talking about TV, a Saturday night before a game or that sort of thing. No one could catch him. So he thought, you know, we've got to look more carefully at him. Good thing they did. Good thing they did. All right, that's going to do it.
Clark, were you covering them when Rice dropped that ball against the Giants in a playoff game?
I was covering that game. Yeah. But that turned out.
They got blown out, didn't they?
Yeah, it was like 49-3 or 48-3, something like that. It's also a game where Joe Montana got hit by Burt, remember, and suffered concussion, left the game. So, yeah, it was over before it started. And that game, the reason I remember that, Ira, I'm going to that game and got caught in traffic on the New Jersey Turnpike. And then on 95, I didn't get into that game until early in the second quarter because the traffic was so bad.
Actually,
I got in there when, and just in time to see Rice drop that pass. And then I saw the Montana hit, and then it was over.
Wow.
I'll tell you what else is over, Ira. This program's over. We're finishing. We're done.
Until next time, Clark.
Yeah,
until
before we leave, we'd like to tell listeners that if you'd like to hear this or any of our iTest for Two podcasts, you can. You just go to our website, maybe itestfor2.com or fullpresscoverage.com. That's producer Ian Glendon's website, and it's a good one. Otherwise, tune in one of these weeks, next week, I don't know, for another edition of the iTest for Two. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you then.